Hi, I'm Bella Gandhi, founder of Smart Dating Academy and your host of this beautiful podcast. We're here to bring more love into your life, regardless of if you're single, if you're married, if you're thinking about becoming single, if you're thinking about becoming married or finding the lid to your pot. And we're going to bring more life into that love that you have or you want. You might have seen me on Good Morning America or Steve Harvey or the Today Show or 100 other places, but I'm so happy that you are here with us because we're going to make your life and your love better. Smart daters, welcome to this week's podcast. And guess what it has to do with? Everybody's favorite three-letter word. Sex. I am bringing back somebody, a great friend of mine, who is just a light in the world and brilliant, Dr. Justin Garcia, who is the not only an amazing human, but the executive director of the Kinsey Institute. So you might have remembered Justin's been on several, many, many episodes ago. And he's also, director of Kinsey and the chief scientific advisor to a small company called Match.com. So Justin just wrote a new book called The Intimate Animal, which is about monogamy. And so I cannot wait to have this conversation. Justin, welcome back to the Smart Dating Academy podcast.
Thank you so much, Bella. It's always good to see you and to get to catch up. And thanks for having me back. There's so much we can talk about. Always.
Oh my gosh. Well, just to fill you guys in from last time, you know, Justin met his wife on a dating app. Okay. Just wrote his personal story in People magazine about being chief scientific advisor to Match and being out there just like all of you dear listeners, slogging it out in the dating world, and then met the one, got married, and now has a baby.
Right. I met my person. And I think it's, well, a couple of things about that. It's fun. Well, as you know, Bella, I don't often talk about my personal life too often. I just happen to be somewhat private as a person, but also because of my work on love and sex and relationships, I'm often careful because if I say something about my relationships, it's also saying something about the other people that I've been involved with. So you bring other people into your storm when you talk. So it was fun to share that. But also, you're right, the dating is a challenging process. It's always been a challenging process. It's a competition and it's complex. And even when you know a lot, when you can, you know, study these materials and know what works, there's the reality of our lives. And that's why I think there's no perfect algorithm, is because relationships are dynamic and dating is dynamic. And there's so many ingredients to put in. But the more we know, I think the more fun we can have and the more success we can have.
Do you want to tell us, just because the listeners out there, so many of you guys are on the dating apps. Mm-hmm. Can you, you know, you were on the apps, you do this work on sex and intimacy and relationships. And what was it like to be on the apps and how did you meet your person?
Yeah. And I think I did something that was really helpful on the apps. I thought about what we were finding in terms of how to have successful matches and early conversations. So things like when you fill out your profile, one thing that we see all the time is people sometimes forget that it's dyadic, that you're searching for someone, people are searching for you. So you can't just put a picture up, one picture or one prompt. You have to fill out your actual profile. And because just as you're looking, people are looking for you, and you want to have things in your profile that someone can hook into. You want to give someone an opportunity to connect with you. So say, oh, is that you're in Milan? I've been wanting to go there, or I haven't been to Italy in 10 years, or something that they can see something about you and what you do and what interests you that they can connect. And so that I was good at. I had pictures that sort of said who I was, like things of traveling and my life, and I filled out the prompts and I was having the initial chats, but then I was falling into the same mistake, which I had written about in our academic work, that there's so many options. How do you really invest in the person in front of you? So I was in a sort of a series of first dates. I was having fun. I actually thought it was quite interesting. And I was getting to learn the town that I had moved to, Bloomington. And I met a lot of wonderful people, a handful I became friends with over time. But I wasn't finding my person. I wasn't finding the kind of relationship that I wanted, that I was craving. And then I had this moment one day that I thought, oh my gosh, I'm falling into the same pattern that we study and we write about, that there's so much data, there's so many people. Part of this paradox of choice is you meet someone and you kind of go through the rush of connecting and the search process, and then you go, well, you're nice, but you held your fork kind of funny, and I can get back on the app and there's 3,000 more people who won't hold their fork funny.
They won't hold their fork funny.
And it's ridiculous in hindsight, but we all do this. We sort of, I mean, you know, right? You talk about these things of how we then kind of hone in on really getting to know someone and going on second dates and third dates and really trying to be vulnerable with another person. And that part I wasn't doing. So I got step one down pretty good, but step two, not so much.
And how did you get over that bridge?
Yeah. Part was I was a little bit older. I was sort of moving into my 30s. I had just started writing this book. My career was in a really good place. And Michelle's career was in a good place. And what was interesting about our early dating, and actually funny story, we were both on apps, but on the dating apps, I don't think I ever told you this part. We were both on the dating apps. We connected. We live in towns that are about 55 minutes away. But we're both pretty sure we connected when we were in Chicago a few weeks before. And I may have been a weekend that I saw you, actually. And so we were pretty sure in hindsight, because we were like, we both opened it. We were just far enough from each other mileage wise that we weren't sure that we would have connected. We were like, well, how, when, where were we that we were in each other's radius? And then we were like, oh, we were both in Chicago 2 weeks ago. But the app's open.
Oh, my God. Wow. So, okay.
Yeah.
And so you said, all right, you know mm-hmm. what? Maybe you're a little bit further than I would mm-hmm. like, but mm-hmm. I'm going to give it a shot.
Yeah. And we gave it a shot. And we went on, we went to brunch at this little town. There's like a little fudge shop town in between our Bloomington and Columbus. And what was great was that it was a little bit more relaxed. We were not... we had a bit of a slower burn, and we were attracted to each other right away. But the pressure, I think, because of where we were in our lives, we laugh about it now. At one point, we talked about both, like, I like being single. Like, there's some nice elements to it. And we laugh now because I said, I remember when she said it, and I thought, well, challenge accepted. And
you're like, I'm going to make you not want to be single.
Yeah, yeah. And we, but it was fun, and it was more relaxed. And in some ways, interestingly, in some ways, the distance, I mean, it's not that far. I grew up in New York. People travel an hour to get to work. And but here, where I can get to work in 15 minutes, the hour distance, it just meant some planning. Like, if we were going to meet late, if we were going to meet for dinner, what time? We each had then had, you know, traveling back and forth. And I think that intention about each date, about planning it and seeing each other, it just, the whole process felt more mature and more focused. And then we would see each other, and then we were more focused on each other, because we were like, I just drove, you know, a half hour to get to you, or an hour once we started going back and forth to the towns. And also respecting, I maybe drove an hour to get to her, I want to focus. But then if she drove an hour to me, I want to respect that she just took an hour out of her day. And then two, really, going back and forth. So in some ways, that little bit of distance forced both of us to be more focused on each other, more intentional about our time together.
Right. And you spent greater chunks of time together than mm-hmm. you might, you know, having a quick coffee on a third date or a fourth date. It's like, okay, I just drove half an hour, so let's make this worth our while.
Yeah, exactly. And then once we started doing the full drive, almost the hour, we're like, okay, let's do lunch and mini golf, or let's do this and that. Like, then, like, starting to put, I later found that she's a really good golfer, so I didn't go golfing with her. But I took lessons at the university. I called a friend of mine. And then we went to the driving range once, and she said, you don't know how to golf, but how are you, like, you're hitting the ball? And I said, I took lessons. And she said, where? And I said, the head golf coach gave me lessons at the university. And she's like, well, that's go big or go home, huh? And I was like, yeah.
So, you're like, welcome to me.
Insight into my person.
Exactly. I'm just going to dig deep. I'm going to call a person, the best person on campus. And here I am. You're like, I'm committed to you.
Yeah,
I love exactly. this. So, I love this. And that mm-hmm. and that's such a great part of relationships, right? It's like, mm-hmm. okay, I may not be a golfer and you're a golfer, mm-hmm. but I'd be open to learning how to play. I may not be as good as you. I may not be PGA rated, but you know what? I'm going to make an effort.
Yeah, exactly. And that curiosity. So I'm a tennis player, she's a golfer, but that curiosity of we go with each other sometimes and we aren't necessarily good at the other one's preferred sport, but to make it fun and to be curious, we know that that's really important. Our research shows how important that curiosity is early on in dating and getting to know someone, but to not lose it through the courtship process and to not lose it later in a relationship, to stay, continue to stay curious about, and moments still come up. I was just giving a speech in Munich, and we were talking, for instance, about she took German in school, and I was like, "How much do you know?" Actually, I didn't know. Like, how many languages are really tucked in there? And we're together for years, but you have these moments that you learn something, and you're curious about each other. So that to not lose that, to continue to cultivate that's the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Well, and that segues perfectly into your book. So let's talk about the intimate animal. I'm just going to give you the floor.
Thanks. I got it right here. So this is my other baby.
I'm going to
And
have it linked in the show notes, and I want you all to go out and get it.
thank you. Thank you. It was a labor of love and my own stories. I write more personally about it than I ever have in my career. And at its core, what I was interested in, a lot of my interests are around monogamy and relationships. And for me, I studied monogamy. And then from there, I looked at hookup culture, infidelity, long-term relationships, relationship and sexual satisfaction. But I was always interested in how it related to long-term pair bonds. And our friend, the late great Helen Fisher, the anthropologist who I worked with on the evolution of pair bonds, how even when I wrote about hookups, I was interested in like, how does that relate to a desire for relationships? And we found 51% of men and women had casual sex, hoping it would turn into a romantic relationship. So I was always asking questions about connection, even in those cases. So at the core of the book, a core theme is I deal with when we talk about monogamy a lot, but as an evolutionary biologist, there's really two parts of monogamy. One is the relationship context, which is social monogamy, what we would call romantic love. In other species, it's called, we use terms like mutual territory defense, mutual nest building, mutual raising of offspring, all the mutual stuff, all the idea that you have this co-CEO that you go through life with. So I was interested in that relationship structure. And in humans, that evolved around 4 million years ago. And then to not take for granted that we even have the capacity to form pair bonds, that we have the ability in our brains to fall in love with another. Only about 3 to 5% of mammals do this. And
Wow.
we have that architecture that evolved in our species. So I talk about the relationship structure, social monogamy, and then sexual monogamy or fidelity is something else. And that's really, in many ways, a different mechanism in the brain. And they were different evolutionary pressures, different levers. So we evolved this tendency for pair bonding, to have a person to weather the storms of life with, to weather uncertainty with. But we also evolved a tendency for sexual novelty. Now,
Wow.
that makes sense to a lot of us when we think about it. This idea of it's the excitement, the rush, the seeking partners, that all is this lever. Now, if you're in a long-term relationship and you desire sexual novelty, for some people, that's why we see infidelity. That's why we see these motivations for sex outside their relationship. It helps explain why more and more people are talking about opening a relationship or consensual non-monogamy. But I don't think those are the only answers to that drive. The other option that we sometimes don't think about is if we have this tendency for sexual novelty or novelty more broadly, as you'll have reminded me, and when we've talked about this, is sensation seeking, that you can do that in the context of the relationship. So your desire for all of our desires for novelty, sexual novelty and sensation, it doesn't have to pull you away from the relationship. When you understand the science, we can harness it and do it in the context of our relationship. But if not, we wake up, many of us, and feel this pull into other directions. And that's for me, it's natural, it's evolved. But when we understand them, we can harness them to have the kind of relationships we want. Maybe it is an open relationship for some people, but we know for most, they're socially monogamous relationships that have a component of fidelity.
And it's so interesting because I think it's sort of the anatomy of romantic love, right? It's really exciting in the beginning. And then when you're with a person, that's good for you longer term once all of the hormones and the chemicals kind of have done their job and, attach you to this person, then all of that excitement turns into these lovely feelings of safety and security, right? And so it sounds like what you're saying is, okay, now we had the excitement, now we feel the safety, but again, because we're humans and, creatures of dissatisfaction and discontent that we're seeking out, and maybe not that we're dissatisfied or discontent, but it's part of our nature to want that novelty again and that excitement. And it sounds like what you're saying is it just because you're feeling that safety and wondering, like, man, I need some excitement, it doesn't necessarily mean, and I see people come out of this tunnel, like, I think I love them, but I'm not in love with them. I'm like, what does that mean?
What
Right?
does that mean?
What does that mean? And what I've come to realize, and I've been married for 28 years. I've been, I created my dating system when I was in college, but have been professionally doing this for 16 years. And what I find is it's something in that, right? It's to your point where I don't know that I love them, but I'm not in love. It's like, okay, you need some excitement. Right. And this is a you thing, and bring your partner into this. So tell me, like, what can we do?
And it's finding that excitement. Sometimes it's a little bit of risk. And that's true. That can trigger in the book, I talk about these examples of studies. One study that I love is it's called Misattribution of Arousal. And there was a case researchers had men walk across a stable bridge or a wire bridge. And the men who walked across the wire bridge, after at the other end, there was a woman researcher who said, "Here's my number. If you have follow-up questions, let me know." The ones who walked across the wire bridge were much more likely to call the woman afterwards and say, "Are you free for a drink or could we go out?" Because their hearts were
They're a
racing and they were
mess.
excited. So the rush, the adrenaline rush, the excitement. So a little bit of risk, a little bit of novelty, is catnip for a relationship. And we can do that when we think of dates. I mean, I think that's the challenge when if you do a movie with someone for a date, as opposed to doing things where you get to know them. I talk about a story in the book where I took a first date zip lining and like the excitement and the rush and that one turned into a relationship for a while. And the how we can harness that, we want to do things where now, to your point, Bella, you don't want to be so risk-taking that you are scared or afraid. Because then what happens is the nervous system tips over the edge into a threat response. And if we're in a threat response, if we're really anxious or and people talk about flight or fight or flight, but there's really fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. There's different reactions of the nervous system, and we want that psychological safety you were talking about to connect. In fact, you have to have a sense of safety for social behavior. It's what's called neuroception. So if you don't feel safe with someone, you don't really connect. And one way to think of it is we don't stop for a chat in a burning building, right? If your nervous system is in a threat response, you're not really socializing. Same, I've often said in the natural world, you'll never see two gazelle mating in front of a lion, right? If you're in a threat response, that's not conducive to social behavior, and it's most certainly not conducive to mating behavior in an evolutionary sense. That includes connection, that includes sexual activity. A little bit of fear, a little bit of stress is fun, is exciting, but you don't want to tip so far over. I had a friend who doesn't know how to swim, and they had a date who took them kayaking, and they said they were just so freaked out the whole time. I said, "What happened afterwards?" Is that I never wanted to talk to him again. I was so freaked out for the hour. And so you want to balance what that novelty is with what you want and what the person you're trying to connect with wants.
Right. You don't want to do something that you're phobic of, right? Right, exactly. Like if you're a person that likes to jump out of planes and so is your date, great. That could be fun together. But if you're afraid of heights, it's probably not a great idea. Not the novelty that you need. That's like, oh, it's not even overstimulation. It's like a trauma response.
You're in a fear response. It's a threat physiology. So
Wow. Okay, so maybe dance lessons. And I think, I have a question that is related, unrelated, that's come to me. Like, okay, let's say there's a couple and they're seeking novelty and they agree to non-monogamy or they agree to open up, whatever. Well, let's have threesomes or whatever all of, ranges on the spectra. Do you know what does the data show about what does that do to trust and intimacy?
It's a big question that people are thinking more about as we talk more about polyamory, open relationships. So in our studies, we found about 1 in 5, 21% of people have at some point in their life had a consensually non-monogamous relationship or a negotiated non-monogamous relationship. Some people prefer that term. The much lower number are currently in one, which suggests that many people try it often when they're younger, but not necessarily as a lifelong relationship structure. The big issues there are, and interestingly, a new paper just came out, a meta-analysis on satisfaction, relationship satisfaction in monogamous and in consensually non-monogamous relationship structures, and they're the same. So that tells us one isn't necessarily better or worse than the other. They just are different structures and require different things. Now, for those couples who are saying, let's open our relationship, that's where we're going to get our novelty. That's what they feel that they need. For some people, it works well. But we know some people it doesn't. Some people it leads to immediate separation. And that distinction, what we do know is a lot of it has to do with communication and trust. So, partly when you have a new partner, you can get what's called new relationship energy. So, you get really focused on the new person. And if you are opening your relationship with the idea of, I want to preserve the pair bond, but then get the novelty, but then you're giving all your attention to the new person. You unintentionally start damaging the primary relationship. So it takes a lot of effort in terms of saying, like, how do I balance my attention, my focus on these different relationships, a lot of communication. I mean, I think all of us can learn from couples that have open relationships about communication. The successful ones communicate a lot. And there's a lot of books on that. And so, there's trust, but then there's also researchers talk about compersion, which is this idea that you get joy from your partner's having joy in multiple places. And that not I don't think everyone I think the evidence would suggest not everyone has that. If you're someone who says, I know that my husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend went out last night and probably hooked up with someone and they had fun and I'm so happy they had fun and that's good for our relationship. That's great, but most people will really suffer with jealousy with that. And that I think is when you have to have a real honest conversation with yourself and your partner. Say, like, are we the type of people and couple who can navigate that? Some, yes, some can harness it. I would say a majority can't. At least that's what the data would suggest. There are people who would probably argue with me and say, well, they could if they train. And that might be true. I think that jealousy is a deeply evolved response. We know that mate guarding and jealousy exist for men and women at all stages of life, and it's not one that everyone can contain that easily.
Because I think you said this in the beginning, and correct me if I'm wrong, like we're wired to be pair bonders. Right. And so it's sort of, I think people that can have non-monogamous relationships and make it work, right? There's a lot of evolution to and communication. And I'm sure that there are structures and rules. I've seen, obviously, in my work, and I'm sure with yours, many different couples that, there are a lot of rules. If we're opening up our relationship, and let's say I said to my husband, you can do this, but I want to be in the room while you're hooking up with this other person, right? And there a lot of people have different rules. It's like, okay, and if that works for you, so the constructs of these things are very different. My question, I think, long term is how does that affect the primary relationship, right? It's like, do I fully trust the fact that I'm your primary, or do I even want to be? I don't know. It's so
Or do you want
fascinating.
to be? Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that I've been interested in is that couples, as relationships progress, they like to have things that are special. They make special things with each other. Sometimes it's nicknames, sometimes it's talking in, or nicknames or pet names, talking in kind of loverese, like lover baby voice, things that you do at home that maybe people don't know about. And But then there's also things that are unique to you. And then you start to wonder, you know, when we were in bed and you told me how much you love my blue eyes. And but do you say that to everyone with blue eyes, or how, like, you start to run this game of, when we look for the special features of our relationship, are they really special? And when you are really thinking about navigating other sexual partners in a relationship, that can be challenging. So you get these sense of jealousy. For some people, it works well, but it's a lot of communication and navigating that. I interviewed one woman that I talk about in the book about, and she and her husband opened their marriage. They had kids. They had hit a real lull. They thought this was the solution, but they did what you said. They actually went on vacations. And would have threesomes when they were on vacations. And it worked really great for a while. And then it hit a point where it didn't. And the husband hadn't really said anything, but he was getting so upset because he's like, this has gotten out of hand. I don't like it anymore. And she said, well, you were the one that introduced that. She didn't really want to do it at the start. And he had encouraged it. So they had a misalignment on who wanted what. He wanted it more. And then he didn't like the consequences of it. That is, you know, seeing his wife interested in other men, and then and they came pretty close to a divorce, actually. So they pulled back from it. They closed their relationship. But that's not easy either. That's because then you're changing a relationship structure and then trying to change it another way. But the things that you've done in the meantime, that influences the trajectory of your relationship dynamic. And I'm not a moralist about it. It's not that open relationships are better or worse. I think that this new satisfaction study is pretty interesting that they're the same. It's just, in my sense is that it doesn't work for most people. There are some people who it works for extraordinarily well, and that's how they find their satisfaction and pleasure. But it's not a one size fits all. Just like monogamy is not for everyone, singlehood is not for everyone, open relationships are not for everyone.
And what would you say, Justin, to people that are out there, daters, and they've got all these different things they can check off or look for, like ethical non-monogamy, consensual non-monogamy? If you're looking for a committed monogamous relationship, then stick to that. What would you say on the dating apps? Because they give you all these options.
There's so many options. Yeah. And I think the challenge in the pursuit of love and relationships and connection is the balance between saying, okay, I want to go outside my comfort zone. Part of what we know in relationships, particularly early on, is we are attracted to the expansion of self, what psychologists call the expansion of self. So we want partners who are going to teach us new things, new experiences. My partner and I, Michelle and I left, when we go on vacation, I'm more of a, like, let's sit on the beach and I want to read a book and I just want to unwind. And Michelle is much more like, here are our adventures every day that we're taking. And I remember the last time we were on vacation in Mexico and she was like, okay, we're going to do this today. And then tomorrow we're going to go to the cenotes and it's like an hour away. And I was like, I just want to lay on the beach and read a book. She's like, come on, let's just do it. Let's just do it. And I really didn't want to. And we did. And we had so much fun. And I was so glad I did it. And it was a part of the country we hadn't seen before. And she laughs and she's like, and she knows that, she was like, it's that expansion of self stuff you talk about. And she's right. Right. It was this pushing each other within reason to experience new things. That's good. Experiencing new things are good. But to your point, Bella, not so much that you're really outside where you're comfortable. So I don't think if someone's dating and looking for a monogamous relationship, I don't think it's a good idea to, you know, start getting serious with someone who has very different interests and relationship structures. If you know that's really not what you're looking for, that can be a real challenge. Now, I mean, if you're curious about it, that's a different story.
Correct.
But not to set up with the expectation, because what can happen is you start to date and then with the expectation, but they'll love me so much, we'll have a closed relationship. And that's a disaster from the start.
Agreed. I usually say, you know, usually people come out there with their intentions.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't listen to the intentions of other people when we're like, oh my God, I really like him. And I know he says he's looking for something short term, but he just doesn't know me yet. I'm like, remember what he said, right? Right.
Yeah.
And they can act as if for the first 3 to 4 months, like this is your boyfriend. They're there 5 nights a week. They're only with you. And then at a certain point where they're like, okay, well, I've met someone else. You're like, wait, what? It's like, well, no, we weren't exclusive.
Yeah, we talked about
We
this.
talked about this. I told you I was, not looking for anything serious. So even though I was acting as if from your perspective, this was serious, it was serious for that point, and now
Yeah.
I'm done.
And it reminds me, there's a series of studies on what's called relationship timeliness. And sometimes you can meet someone who you really like, or but their intentions are different, what their goals are for relationships are different. And sometimes it's just the moment in time that you meet them. And I think that's hard for all of us to wrap our heads around. Sometimes you could say, I met this person who's great, but I'm about to move across the country for work, or but I'm about to be overseas for 2 years, or but I'm still going through a breakup, or but I don't really want that now. And we don't often think about this timeliness or readiness in relationships, but in fact, it's a huge element of what makes dating and starting relationships complicated, because sometimes you're just not. You're not, you can feel deeply attracted to someone. You could really desire someone, but you're not really in the right place to establish a relationship. And I love how you put it. Sometimes you just got to hear what someone's saying, and like, we're not on the same field right now.
Yeah, and being the mother of 2 young adults, one is a senior in high school, one is a senior in college, right? It's that tumultuous time where you might be in a relationship and then suddenly, well, we're going to go to different colleges, so we're going to break up. Or, my son will say, what's the point of trying to date anybody at this point? Because, like, seriously, and just wait until you get to college because you're going to go to 2 different schools, and who wants to deal with the long distance relationship? So the timing of things, is, and especially during that younger, like where Gen Z is, or like 18 to 28, when your life is like, I don't know where my next job is going to land me up. I don't know where, you might meet this person on vacation and they live in California and you live in New York. Like, how do I navigate these things? So timing, and situations play a big role.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we sometimes can get too focused on that. We forget that there's so many people that we can form meaningful relationships with in the world. There's so much opportunity to connect. And that has to align with where we are and where they are. And that could be hard to wrap our heads around sometimes. We're like, I like them. It doesn't matter. I don't care about all the other noise of life, but it's there and they care about it.
It's there. It's there. So, do you have, a couple of nuggets that you can share with our listeners from the book that could kind of make them better where they are today, like based on what you found? Because I know you're like a basket of nuggets walking around Earth that are
I've got
helpful to
some.
all of us, including me.
I've got some. It's funny, I'll mention one on Gen Z that I only touched on a little bit because it's actually newer data that we're analyzing after I had turned the book in. We just finished this study, which with Match Group, that 80% of Gen Z say that they are really ready for love, that 80% say that they want love, excuse me, that they want to find a relationship. But about half, 45%, say that they don't think they're ready. And I've increasingly been thinking about this idea of self-actualization and what does it mean to be ready? And I actually think it's kind of startling that so many young people are saying that they have this idea that they need to work on themselves to be ready before they can go date. And I often think, did our ancestors have to work on themselves? Does a gorilla have to work on themselves? And I think, a little bit. Sometimes there's an element to that if you're grieving or if you're not, you got to put your best foot forward, sure. The challenge is when we spend all this time on readiness, one is we self-sabotage. So we know from the relationship science literature, if you're really focused on this idea of not thinking you're ready, then you don't show up ready. So if people who don't think they're ready for a relationship, when they get into them, they don't commit as much. They have exit plans. They're more likely to start planning how to get out of the relationship. So you one have this idea that you are not fully ready. But the other is it plays into this if I could say it, kind of like psychobabble about
Say it all.
Like that. And it assumes that readiness is linear. Like you just hit one moment, you wake up one day and you're ready. And there are days that, I mean, there are days I'm ready for work. There's days I'm not ready for work. I mean, we move back and forth in these readiness measures. And same with our relationships. There are days that we show up fully for our relationships. And there are days that you look at your partner and say, I think you need to show up a little bit more today because I'm not fully here. That's the reality of relationship dynamics. And this idea that we have to go work on ourselves in isolation or solo and then show up to a relationship. The relationship is the container within which we learn about ourselves and we make mistakes. We take risks with a co-pilot we trust, with exactly that, like you were talking about earlier, that person that we have safety and trust with to take risks, to experience the world. So I think we're too many people, unfortunately, are focused on this, you know, self-actualization scheme.
No, it's so true. And I think so much of that is fed by social media, right?
Yeah. You know,
oh my gosh. You know, my daughter's like, well, I think she's avoidant and he's anxious. And it's like, you know, a lot of, and like, maybe, could be. Why don't we just test it out and see where it goes? So
give them a scale.
Right. Exactly. Let's just date and see how they show up. Yeah. And then you can make your, analyses. And then when they do show up in that way, then it's time for you to say, this isn't for me. And it's okay to walk away.
Exactly. And we understand more and more that people change in the context of relationships. We know from all sorts of studies and from anecdotes that are people who say, I'm not sure if I want kids. And then you meet someone you love and you want them suddenly. Or maybe you're a little bit avoidant and then you feel safe with someone and you're more securely attached. 20 years ago, people talked about attachment as being stable and never changing. We now know that it can change in the context of relationships. So that research is updated, is giving us new understanding. So, I totally agree with you. We have to be cautious about and same with gaslighting and people. For me, these are technical terms that we use as we understand relationships. And, you know, maybe sometimes you're being gaslit. And maybe sometimes you're hearing things you don't want to hear. And that's not necessarily the same.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's like, well, are they really a narcissist or are they just a jerk or kind of an asshole? Like,
I have a friend who studies narcissism and she will often say, she's like, there are narcissists. There's not as many as people think, you know, like clinical narcissists, but there is, so I'm trying to think some other nuggets. Something else I wrote about, I did a whole chapter on breakups and the reason why, not to bring us down to a sad moment for a bit, but we're talking about narcissists.
It's
okay.
The reality.
Yeah. And I think I've gotten more and more interest. So a lot of my interests are on the on-ramps and off-ramps of relationships. And I've gotten more interested in how people experience those off-ramps, what goes on in the brain, what goes on in our bodies. And in part, I think we don't often give people enough space to grieve when a relationship ends. It really is a bereavement process. When you are deeply attached to someone, when you love them and you break that bond up, the body goes through loss. It goes through pain. I mean, we know people who go through relationship loss feel physical pain. fMRI brain studies show that. And that you've lost this big thing in your life, but we treat it so differently than if someone lost a sibling or a best friend or a family member. We kind of expect them to kind of quickly move on. And that's a challenge because you're trying to balance. How do you honor that you love someone once, even if you now maybe hate them for some reasons or, you know, not some breakups.
For many reasons.
Yeah. Some breakups happen and some happen with pain, with a lot of hurt and lack of trust. Others happen and they're a surprise. But that doesn't mean you don't stop feeling bonded to the person. It's why, I mean, we found 50% of people who have had yo-yo relationships. You break up, you go back, you break up, you go back. Because it's even when you try and sever those bonds, it can be hard. It's why I think a lot of people look up their exes on social media and not necessarily because you're still in love with them, but you are connected. Once you've ever loved someone, a piece of them stays with you, I believe. The bonds are too, Mother Nature made these bonds too intense to just dissolve. So I think we can have a lot more compassion for ourselves and for others when we understand that, when we understand the intensity of pair bonds and how they stay with us, that, you know, you will hurt when you go through a relationship dissolution. And so will your friends and your loved ones. And how do we have a bit more compassion, how we think about that? And then how, when we understand that, how do we also understand that when we date again, which we should and we can, and when we love again, that you're not necessarily looking for the same thing. And there are elements that we do repeat because it's what we really wanted, but then there are elements you don't want to repeat. Now you balance how you balance that. The reality is you'll never date someone again. Relationships are too dynamic. Personalities are too unique. So how do you really think of forming a new chapter with a new person?
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that because I often get people into our practice that have recently broken up, divorced, they're widowed, whatever the case may be, but especially in breakups, you know, and this urge for on again, off again, and I just want contact. I think, you know, something that you and Helen Fisher taught me, it's looking at the fMRI studies of people that are in love or grieving. And I tell my clients, like, your brain is looking for that substance. It's like your heroin, your cocaine, like the person you were with feels like, you know, it was your addiction, it was your obsession. And suddenly that person has been removed. And so now your brain is doing everything it can, putting up all these positive images of all these fun times in the beginning and the safe and the excitement and the fun stuff you used to do. And your brain is doing that to try to get you to bring the addiction, that heroin, I call it there. Sometimes I'm like, that is your crack cocaine. That's your heroin. Yeah. It's not good for you. So know that this is what your brain is trying to do right now and be gentle with yourself, but also know what's actually happening and just try to withstand the waves. And one of the other things I do is, okay, that was the beginning of the relationship, but you broke up because it wasn't like that anymore. So make a list of all of the negative things that happened at the end that caused the breakup so you can counteract the obsession of the beginning. It wasn't the beginning that broke you up. It was the end. What happened at the end? And look at that list every single day. So that you can counteract that. So
I love that. And it's I find it, I think that's so empowering about really thinking, how do we, you know, our brain is doing all this stuff. You're right. It looks, a brain going through relationship dissolution looks remarkably like someone going through cocaine withdrawal. And so if we know that, how do you kind of grab biology by the horns and say, I'm going to take control of these drives, of these motivations? We have to. Otherwise, we just get moved around like relationship zombies. But we need to really own, understand our biology, understand how our bodies and our minds and our psychologies are working. Then we can harness it. And that's the best advice. I love that.
Right. I tell people, you're not weak for feeling this. Our brains are wired for this. So sometimes, especially with me, maybe it's because I tend to be my finance analytical person by education. And but when I understand the mechanics of something, I'm like, oh, okay, there's a why to this. So now if I understand what my brain's trying to do, it's not because I'm weak. It's because my brain wants the cocaine back. And it's like, but cocaine's really bad for you, Bella. So make a list of all the reasons the coke is bad for you. Yeah. Withstand the craving. You know the craving is going to dissipate if you give it a long enough time. Don't go back to the cocaine and you'll be okay. Yeah. So, it's those lists. I'm like, did you make your list of, we called it like negative discernment, like make that list of all of the bad things that this person did, said, how they treated you, and like scotch tape that to your hand if you need to look at it every 5 seconds.
Yeah. And sometimes even if you wanted to go back, you can't. So there's also these other, I mean, I think that's also why it's helpful to understand the biology of love and sex and fidelity and breakups. It's the same. I mean, people often talk about love as a verb and it's an action. And I think there's the component to that that I like. But for me, love is a noun. It's a neuropsychological state of being. And what I mean about that, I think there's a difference between love and a healthy relationship. A healthy relationship is absolutely a verb. It's an action. But you can be in love with someone who treats you like garbage, and you can be in love with someone who you treat terribly, that because it's really this state of being, that being in love and having a healthy relationship are not the same thing. So when we understand that process, then exactly as you're saying, we can start to navigate and take control and say, like, you know, that person was, you might feel drawn to them, you feel addicted to them, but it wasn't the right thing for you. So how do we find something else?
How do we find something else, right? You just got to withstand the wave. So, this was so fun, and I'm really excited for people to dig more into your work. Where can we find the book? Obviously, we're going to put it in show notes, but for
Thank
somebody that
you.
might be driving along right
Yeah.
now.
Thank you. Well, The Intimate Animal, it's available everywhere, and in the US now, and in the United Kingdom it'll be available starting February 12th, and globally soon. So the other editions are coming out, but you can find The Intimate Animal anywhere online, and ebook, audiobook, print book. And if folks follow me on social media, Dr. Justin Garcia, I've been posting updates of events that we're doing, and we'll be together for one soon and another one.
So
And
exciting.
thanks so much for having me. It's always so fun to get to talk to you and your audience with all that about this
Well, we're going to have more follow-ups because you're just such a delight and
stuff.
full of such great energy and great information for all of us. I feel like I'm better after I talk to you,
Oh,
Justin.
thank you. Thank you. Likewise. I'm grateful for you.
I'm grateful for you too. So, smart daters, we're grateful for you as
That's
well. And
right.
thank you for listening to this podcast. If you like this episode, I mean, Justin's amazing. Share this episode with your friends. Let's talk about monogamy. Let's talk about novelty, right? If you're feeling that, like go take some dance lessons. Let's talk about all the things. So share this episode, give it a 5-star rating. And until next time, we will see you at Smart Dating Academy at the podcast. Thanks for listening. And as always, download us, share us, show us the love, follow Instagram at Smart Dating Academy. And if you or someone you know wants to learn more, check out our website at smartdatingacademy.com. We're here to bring you love.